Maybe that's where I did see it. Remembered it from a movie. Because where else would I have seen a garden like that? With white marble steps. Fountains. And away down below, if you go to the edge of the garden, you can see the ocean. Terrific. Like around Carmel, California. The best thing, though. Well, it's a long, long table. You never imagined so much food. Oysters, turkeys, hot dogs, fruit you could make into a million fruit cups. And listen, it's every bit free. I mean, I don't have to be afraid to touch it. I can eat as much as I want, and it won't cost a cent. That's how I know where I am. Dick said, I'm a normal. I only dream about blonde chicken. Speaking of which, you hear about the nanny goat's nightmare? That was Dick, always ready with a dirty joke on any subject. But he told the joke well, and Perry, though he was in some measure a prude, could not help laughing, as always. Speaking of her friendship with Nancy Clutter, Susan Kidwell said, We were like sisters. At least that's how I felt about her, as though she were my sister. I couldn't go to school. Not those first few days. I stayed out of school until after the funeral. So did Bobby Rupp. For a while, Bobby and I were always together. He's a nice boy. He has a good heart. But nothing very terrible had ever happened to him before. Like losing anyone he'd loved. And then on top of it, having to take a lie detector test. I don't mean he was bitter about that. He realized the police were doing what they had to do. Some hard things, two or three, had already happened to me, but not to him. So it was a shock when he found out maybe life isn't one long basketball game. Mostly we just drove around in his old Ford. Up and down the highway. Out to the airport and back. Or we'd go to the Creamy, that's a drive-in, and sit in the car, order a Coke, listen to the radio. The radio was always playing. We didn't have anything to say ourselves. Except once in a while Bobby said how much he'd loved Nancy, and how he could never care about another girl. Well, I was sure Nancy wouldn't have wanted that, and I told him so. I remember, I think it was Monday, we drove down to the river. We parked on the bridge. You can see the house from there, the Clutter house, and part of the land, Mr. Clutter's fruit orchard and the wheat fields going away. Way off in one of the fields, a bonfire was burning. They were burning stuff from the house. Everywhere you looked, there was something to remind you. Men with nets and poles were fishing along the banks of the river, but not fishing for fish. Bobby said they were looking for the weapons. The knife. The gun. Nancy loved the river. Summer nights we used to ride double on Nancy's horse, Babe. That old fat gray. Ride straight to the river and right into the water. Then Babe would wade along in the shallow part while we played our flutes and sang. Got cool. I keep wondering, gosh, what will become of her? Babe. A lady from Garden City took Kenyon's dog. Took Teddy. He ran away. Found his way back to Holcomb. But she came and got him again. And I have Nancy's cat, Evinrude. But Babe. I suppose they'll sell her. Wouldn't Nancy hate that? Wouldn't she be furious? Another day, the day before the funeral, Bobby and I were sitting by the railroad tracks, watching the trains go by. Real stupid. Like sheep in a blizzard. When suddenly Bobby woke up and said, We ought to go see Nancy. We ought to be with her. So we drove to Garden City. Went to the Phillips funeral home, there on Main Street. I think Bobby's kid brother was with us. Yes, I'm sure he was. Because I remember we picked him up after school. And I remember he said how there wasn't going to be any school the next day, so all the Holcomb kids could go to the funeral. And he kept telling us what the kids thought. He said the kids were convinced it was the work of a hired killer. I didn't want to hear about it. Just gossip and talk. Everything Nancy despised. Anyway, I don't much care who did it. Somehow it seems beside the point. My friend is gone. Knowing who killed her isn't going to bring her back. What else matters? They wouldn't let us. At the funeral parlor, I mean. They said no one could view the family. Except the relatives. But Bobby insisted, and finally the undertaker. He knew Bobby and, I guess, felt sorry for him. He said, all right, be quiet about it, but come on in. Now I wish we hadn't. The four coffins, which quite filled the small, flower-crowded parlor, were to be sealed at the funeral services. Very understandably, for despite the care taken with the appearance of the victims, the effect achieved was disquieting. Nancy wore her dress of cherry red velvet, her brother a bright plaid shirt. The parents were more sedately attired, Mr. Clutter in navy blue flannel, his wife in navy blue crepe. And it was this, especially, that lent the scene an awful aura. The head of each was completely encased in cotton, a swollen cocoon twice the size of an ordinary blown-up balloon. And the cotton, because it had been sprayed with a glossy substance, twinkled like Christmas tree snow. Susan at once retreated. I went outside and waited in the car, she recalled. Across the street, a man was raking leaves. I kept looking at him, because I didn't want to close my eyes. I thought, if I do, I'll faint. So I watched him rake leaves and burn them. Watched without really seeing him. Because all I could see was the dress. I knew it so well. I helped her pick the material. It was her own design, and she sewed it herself. I remember how excited she was the first time she wore it. At a party. All I could see was Nancy's red velvet. And Nancy in it. Dancing. The Kansas City Star printed a lengthy account of the Clutter funeral, but the edition containing the article was 2 days old before Perry, lying abed in a hotel room, got around to reading it. Even so, he merely skimmed through, skipped about among the paragraphs. 1,000 persons, the largest crowd in the 5-year history of the First Methodist Church, attended services for the 4 victims today. Several classmates of Nancy's from Holcomb High School wept as the Reverend Leonard Cohen said, God offers us courage, love, and hope, even though we walk through the shadows of the valley of death. I'm sure he was with them in their last hours. Jesus has never promised us we would not suffer pain or sorrow, but he has always said he would be there to help us bear the sorrow and the pain. On the unseasonably warm day, about 600 persons went to the Valley View Cemetery on the north edge of this city. There, at graveside services, they recited the Lord's Prayer. Their voices, massed together in a low whisper, could be heard throughout the cemetery. 1,000 people. Perry was impressed. He wondered how much the funeral had cost. Money was greatly on his mind, though not as relentlessly as it had been earlier in the day. A day he'd begun without the price of a cat's meow. The situation had improved since then. Thanks to Dick, he and Dick now possessed a pretty fair stick, enough to get them to Mexico. Dick. Smooth. Smart. Yes, you had to hand it to him. Christ, it was incredible how he could con a guy. Like the clerk in the Kansas City, Missouri clothing store, the first of the places Dick had decided to hit. As for Perry, he'd never tried to pass a check. He was nervous, but Dick told him, all I want you to do is stand there. Don't laugh, and don't be surprised at anything I say. You got to play these things by ear. For the task proposed, it seemed, Dick had perfect pitch. He breezed in, breezily introduced Perry to the clerk as a friend of mine about to get married, and went on, I'm his best man, helping him kinda shop around for the clothes he'll want. Ha ha, what you might say is, ha ha, trousseau. The salesman ate it up, and soon Perry, stripped of his denim trousers, was trying on a gloomy suit that the clerk considered ideal for an informal ceremony. After commenting on the customer's oddly proportioned figure, the oversized torso supported by the undersized legs, he added, I'm afraid we haven't anything that would fit without alteration. Oh, said Dick, that was okay. There was plenty of time. The wedding was a week tomorrow. That settled, they then selected a gaudy array of jackets and slacks regarded as appropriate for what was to be, according to Dick, a Florida honeymoon. You know the Eden Rock, Dick said to the salesman. In Miami Beach. They got reservations. A present from her folks. 2 weeks at $40 a day. How about that? An ugly runt like him. He's making it with a honey she's not only built, but loaded. While guys like you and me, good-looking guys. The clerk presented the bill. Dick reached in his hip pocket, frowned, snapped his fingers, and said, Hot damn, I forgot my wallet. Which to his partner seemed a ploy so feeble that it couldn't possibly fool a day-old nigger. The clerk apparently was not of that opinion, for he produced a blank check, and when Dick made it out for $80 more than the bill totaled, instantly paid over the difference in cash. Outside, Dick said, So you're gonna get married next week? Well, you'll need a ring. Moments later, riding in Dick's aged Chevrolet, they arrived at a store named Best Jewelry. From there, after purchasing by check a diamond engagement ring and a diamond wedding band, they drove to a pawn shop to dispose of these items. Perry was sorry to see them go. He'd begun to half-credit the make-believe bride, though in his conception of her, as opposed to Dick's, she was not rich, not beautiful. Rather, she was nicely groomed, gently spoken, was conceivably a college graduate. In any event, a very intellectual type. A sort of girl he'd always wanted to meet, but in fact never had. Unless you counted Cookie, the nurse he'd known when he was hospitalized as a result of his motorcycle accident. A swell kid, Cookie, and she had liked him, pitied him, babied him, inspired him to read serious literature. Gone with the Wind, This Is My Beloved. Sexual episodes of a strange and stealthy nature had occurred, and love had been mentioned, and marriage too. But eventually, when his injuries had mended, he'd told her goodbye and given her, by way of explanation, a poem he pretended to have written. There's a race of men that don't fit in, a race that can't stay still. So they break the hearts of kith and kin, and they roam the world at will. They range the field and they rove the flood, and they climb the mountain's crest. Theirs is the curse of the gypsy blood, and they don't know how to rest. If they just went straight, they might go far. They are strong and brave and true, but they're always tired of the things that are, and they want the strange and new. He had not seen her again, or ever heard from or of her. Yet several years later he'd had her name tattooed on his arm, and once, when Dick asked who Cookie was, he'd said, Nobody. A girl I almost married. That Dick had been married, married twice, and had fathered 3 sons was something he envied. A wife. Children. Those were experiences a man ought to have, even if, as with Dick, they didn't make him happy or do him any good. The rings were pawned for $150. They visited another jewelry store, Goldman's, and sauntered out of there with a man's gold wristwatch. Next stop, an Elko camera store, where they bought an elaborate motion picture camera. Cameras are your best investment, Dick informed Perry. Easiest thing to hawk or sell. Cameras and TV sets. This being the case, they decided to obtain several of the latter, and having completed the mission, went on to attack a few more clothing emporiums. Shepherd and Foster's, Rothschild's, Shopper's Paradise. By sundown, when the stores were closing, their pockets were filled with cash and the car was heaped with saleable, pawnable wares. Surveying this harvest of shirts and cigarette lighters, expensive machinery and cheap cufflinks, Perry felt elatedly tall. Now, Mexico. A new chance. A really living life. But Dick seemed depressed. He shrugged off Perry's praises. "I mean it, Dick. You were amazing. Half the time I believed you myself." And Perry was puzzled. He could not fathom why Dick, usually so full of himself, should suddenly, when he had good cause to gloat, be meek, look wilted and sad. Perry said, "I'll stand you a drink." They stopped at a bar. Dick drank 3 orange blossoms. After the 3rd, he abruptly asked, "What about Dad?" "I feel... oh, Jesus. He's such a good old guy. And my mother... well, you saw her. What about them? Me, I'll be off in Mexico. Or wherever. But they'll be right here when those checks start to bounce. I know Dad. He'll want to make them good. Like he tried to before. And he can't. He's old and he's sick. He ain't got anything." "I sympathize with that," said Perry truthfully. Without being kind, he was sentimental, and Dick's affection for his parents, his professed concern for them, did indeed touch him. "But hell, Dick, it's very simple," Perry said. "We can pay off the checks. Once we're in Mexico, once we get started down there, we'll make money. Lots of it." "How?" "How?" What could Dick mean? The question dazed Perry. After all, such a rich assortment of ventures had been discussed. Prospecting for gold, skin diving for sunken treasure. These were but 2 of the projects Perry had ardently proposed. And there were others. The boat, for instance. They had often talked of a deep-sea fishing boat, which they would buy, man themselves, and rent to vacationers. This, though neither had ever skippered a canoe or hooked a guppy. Then, too, there was quick money to be made chauffeuring stolen cars across South American borders. You get paid $500 a trip, or so Perry had read somewhere. But of the many replies he might have made, he chose to remind Dick of the fortune awaiting them on Cocos Island, a land speck off the coast of Costa Rica. "No fooling, Dick," Perry said. "This is authentic. I've got a map. I've got the whole history. It was buried there back in 1821. Peruvian bullion, jewelry. $60 million. That's what they say it's worth. Even if we didn't find all of it. Even if we found only some of it. Are you with me, Dick?" Heretofore, Dick had always encouraged him, listened attentively to his talk of maps, tales of treasure, but now, and it had not occurred to him before, he wondered if all along Dick had only been pretending, just kidding him. The thought, acutely painful, passed, for Dick, with a wink and a playful jab, said, "Sure, honey. I'm with you. All the way." It was 3 in the morning, and the telephone rang again. Not that the hour mattered. Al Dewey was wide awake anyway, and so were Marie and their sons, 9-year-old Paul and 12-year-old Alvin Adams Dewey, Jr. For who could sleep in a house? A modest 1-story house where all night the telephone had been sounding every few minutes. As he got out of bed, Dewey promised his wife, "This time I'll leave it off the hook." But it was not a promise he dared keep. True, many of the calls came from news-hunting journalists, or would-be humorists, or theorists. "Al, listen, fella, I've got this deal figured. It's suicide and murder. I happened to know Herb was in a bad way financially. He was spread pretty thin. So what does he do? He takes out this big insurance policy, shoots Bonnie and the kids, and kills himself with a bomb. A hand grenade stuffed with buckshot. Or anonymous persons with poison pen minds. Know them L's? Foreigners? Don't work? Give parties? Serve cocktails? Where's the money come from? Wouldn't surprise me a darn if they ain't at the roots of this clutter trouble. Or nervous ladies alarmed by the gossip going around, rumors that knew neither ceiling nor cellar. Alvin, now, I've known you since you were a boy, and I want you to tell me straight out whether it's so. I loved and respected Mr. Clutter, and I refuse to believe that that man, that Christian, I refuse to believe he was chasing after women. But most of those who telephoned were responsible citizens wanting to be helpful. I wonder if you've interviewed Nancy's friend, Sue Kidwell. I was talking to the child, and she said something that struck me. She said the last time she ever spoke to Nancy, Nancy told her Mr. Clutter was in a real bad mood. Had been the past 3 weeks. That she thought he was very worried about something, so worried he'd taken to smoking cigarettes. Either that or the callers were people officially concerned. Law officers and sheriffs from other parts of the state. This may be something, may not, but a bartender here says he overheard two fellas discussing the case in terms made it sound like they had a lot to do with it. And while none of these conversations had as yet done more than make extra work for the investigators, it was always possible that the next one might be, as Dewey put it, the break that brings down the curtain. On answering the present call, Dewey immediately heard, "I want to confess." He said, "To whom am I speaking, please?" The caller, a man, repeated his original assertion and added, "I did it. I killed them all." "Yes," said Dewey. "Now if I could have your name and address..." "Oh, no, you don't," said the man, his voice thick with inebriated indignation. "I'm not going to tell you anything. Not till I get the reward. You send the reward, then I'll tell you who I am. That's final." Dewey went back to bed. "No, honey," he said. "Nothing important. Just another drunk."
What did he want?
"Wanted to confess. Provided we sent the reward first." A Kansas paper, the Hutchinson News, had offered $1,000 for information leading to the solution of the crime.
"Alvin, are you lighting another cigarette? Honestly, Alvin, can't you at least try to sleep?"
He was too tense to sleep, even if the telephone could be silenced. Too fretful and frustrated. None of his leads had led anywhere, except perhaps down a blind alley toward the blankest of walls. Bobby Rupp? The polygraph machine had eliminated Bobby. And Mr. Smith, the farmer who tied rope knots identical with those used by the murderer. He, too, was a discarded suspect, having established that on the night of the crime he'd been off in Oklahoma. Which left the Johns, father and son, but they had also submitted provable alibis. So, to quote Harold Nye, "It all adds up to a nice round number. Zero." Even the hunt for the grave of Nancy's cat had come to nothing. Nevertheless, there had been one or two meaningful developments. First, while sorting Nancy's clothes, Mrs. Elaine Seltzer, her aunt, had found tucked in the toe of a shoe a gold wristwatch. Second, accompanied by a KBI agent, Mrs. Helm had explored every room at River Valley Farm, toured the house in the expectation that she might notice something awry or absent, and she had. It happened in Kenyon's room. Mrs. Helm looked and looked, paced round and round the room with pursed lips, touching this and that. Kenyon's old baseball mitt, Kenyon's mud-spattered work boots, his pathetic abandoned spectacles. All the while she kept whispering, "Something here is wrong. I feel it. I know it, but I don't know what it is." And then she did know.
"It's the radio. Where is Kenyon's little radio?
Taken together, these discoveries forced Dewey to consider again the possibility of plain robbery as a motive. Surely that watch had not tumbled into Nancy's shoe by accident. She must, lying there in the dark, have heard sounds. Footfalls, perhaps voices, that led her to suppose thieves were in the house, and so believing must have hurriedly hidden the watch. A gift from her father that she treasured. As for the radio, a gray portable made by Zenith. No doubt about it, the radio was gone. All the same, Dewey could not accept the theory that the family had been slaughtered for paltry profit. A few dollars and a radio. To accept it would obliterate his image of the killer. Or rather, killers. He and his associates had definitely decided to pluralize the term. The expert execution of the crimes was proof enough that at least one of the pair commanded an immoderate amount of cool-headed slyness and was, must be, a person too clever to have done such a deed without calculated motive. Then, too, Dewey had become aware of several particulars that reinforced his conviction that at least one of the murderers was emotionally involved with the victims and felt for them even as he destroyed them. A certain twisted tenderness. How else explain the mattress box? The business of the mattress box was one of the things that most tantalized Dewey. Why had the murderers taken the trouble to move the box from the far end of the basement room and lay it on the floor in front of the furnace, unless the intention had been to make Mr. Clutter more comfortable? To provide him, while he contemplated the approaching knife, with a couch less rigid than cold cement. And in studying the death scene photographs, Dewey had distinguished other details that seemed to support his notion of a murderer now and again moved by considerate impulses. Or, he could never quite find the word he wanted, something fussy and soft. Those bed covers. Now, what kind of person would do that? Tie up two women, the way Bonnie and the girl were tied, and then draw up the bed covers. Tuck them in, like sweet dreams and good night. Or the pillow under Kenyon's head. At first I thought maybe the pillow was put there to make his head a simpler target. Now I think, no. It was done for the same reason the mattress box was spread on the floor. To make the victim more comfortable. But speculations such as these, though they absorbed Dewey, did not gratify him or give him a sense of getting somewhere. A case was seldom solved by fancy theories. He put his faith in facts, sweated for and sworn to. The quantity of facts to be sought and sifted, and the agenda planned to obtain them, promised perspiration aplenty, entailing as it did the tracking down, the checking out of hundreds of people, among them all former River Valley Farm employees, friends and family, anyone with whom Mr. Clutter had done business, much or little, a tortoise crawl into the past. For as Dewey had told his team, we have to keep going till we know the Clutters better than they ever knew themselves. Until we see the connection between what we found last Sunday morning and something that happened maybe 5 years ago. The link. Got to be one. Got to. Dewey's wife dozed, but she awakened when she felt him leave their bed, heard him once more answering the telephone, and heard, from the nearby room where her son slept, sobs, a small boy crying. Paul? Ordinarily, Paul was neither troubled nor troublesome. Not a whiner, ever. He was too busy digging tunnels in the backyard or practicing to be the fastest runner in Finney County. But at breakfast that morning, he'd burst into tears. His mother had not needed to ask him why. She knew that although he understood only hazily the reasons for the uproar around him, he felt endangered by it. By the harassing telephone, and the strangers at the door, and his father's worry-wearied eyes. She went to comfort Paul. His brother, 3 years older, helped. Paul, he said, you take it easy now, and tomorrow I'll teach you to play poker. Dewey was in the kitchen. Marie, searching for him, found him there, waiting for a pot of coffee to percolate and with the murder scene photographs spread before him on the kitchen table. Bleak stains, spoiling the table's pretty fruit-patterned oilcloth. Once he had offered to let her look at the pictures. She had declined. She had said, "I want to remember Bonnie the way Bonnie was." And all of them. He said, "Maybe the boys ought to stay with Mother." His mother, a widow, lived not far off, in a house she thought too spacious and silent. The grandchildren were always welcome. For just a few days. Until... "Alvin, do you think we'll ever get back to normal living?" Mrs. Dewey asked. Their normal life was like this. Both worked. Mrs. Dewey as an office secretary, and they divided between them the household chores, taking turns at the stove and the sink. When Alvin was sheriff, I know some of the boys teased him. Used to say, "Look a yonder, here comes Sheriff Dewey, tough guy, totes a six-shooter. But once he gets home, off comes the gun and on goes the apron." At that time, they were saving to build a house on a farm that Dewey had bought in 1951. 240 acres several miles north of Garden City. If the weather was fine, and especially when the days were hot and the wheat was high and ripe, he liked to drive out there and practice his draw. Shoot crows, tin cans. Or, in his imagination, roam through the house he hoped to have, and through the garden he meant to plant, and under trees yet to be seeded. He was very certain that some day his own oasis of oaks and elms would stand upon those shadeless plains. Some day, God willing. A belief in God and the rituals surrounding that belief. Church every Sunday, grace before meals, prayers before bed, were an important part of the Dewey's existence. "I don't see how anyone can sit down to table without wanting to bless it," Mrs. Dewey once said. "Sometimes when I come home from work, well, I'm tired. But there's always coffee on the stove, and sometimes a steak in the icebox. The boys make a fire to cook the steak, and we talk, and tell each other our day, and by the time supper's ready, I know we have good cause to be happy and grateful. So I say thank you, Lord. Not just because I should, because I want to." "Now," Mrs. Dewey said, "Alvin, answer me. Do you think we'll ever have a normal life again?" He started to reply, but the telephone stopped him. The old Chevrolet left Kansas City November 21st, Saturday night. Luggage was lashed to the fenders and roped to the roof. The trunk was so stuffed it could not be shut. Inside, on the back seat, two television sets stood, one atop the other. It was a tight fit for the passengers. Dick, who was driving, and Perry, who sat clutching the old Gibson guitar, his most beloved possession. As for Perry's other belongings, a cardboard suitcase, a gray Zenith portable radio, a gallon jug of root beer syrup, he feared that his favorite beverage might not be available in Mexico, and two big boxes containing books, manuscripts, cherished memorabilia, and hadn't Dick raised hell, cursed, kicked the boxes, called them 500 pounds of pig slop. These, too, were part of the car's untidy interior. Around midnight, they crossed the border into Oklahoma. Perry, glad to be out of Kansas, at last relaxed. Now it was true. They were on their way. On their way and never coming back. Without regret, as far as he was concerned, for he was leaving nothing behind, and no one who might deeply wonder into what thin air he'd spiraled. The same could not be said of Dick. There were those Dick claimed to love. 3 sons, a mother, a father, a brother. Persons he hadn't dared confide his plans to, or bid goodbye, though he never expected to see them again. Not in this life. Clutter English vows given in Saturday ceremony. That headline, appearing on the social page of the Garden City Telegram for November 23rd, surprised many of its readers. It seemed that Beverly, the second of Mr. Clutter's surviving daughters, had married Mr. Vere Edward English, the young biology student to whom she had long been engaged. Miss Clutter had worn white, and the wedding, a full-scale affair, Mrs. Leonard Cohen was soloist and Mrs. Howard Blanchard organist, had been solemnized at the First Methodist Church, the church in which, 3 days earlier, the bride had formally mourned her parents, her brother, and her younger sister. However, according to the telegram's account, Vere and Beverly had planned to be married at Christmas time. The invitations were printed, and her father had reserved the church for that date. Due to the unexpected tragedy, and because of the many relatives being here from distant places, the young couple decided to have their wedding Saturday. The wedding over, the Clutter kinfolk dispersed. On Monday, the day the last of them left Garden City, the telegram featured on its front page a letter written by Mr. Howard Fox of Oregon, Illinois, a brother of Bonnie Clutter. The letter, after expressing gratitude to the townspeople for having opened their homes and hearts to the bereaved family, turned into a plea. "There is much resentment in this community," that is Garden City, wrote Mr. Fox. "I have even heard on more than one occasion that the man, when found, should be hanged from the nearest tree. Let us not feel this way. The deed is done, and taking another life cannot change it. Instead, let us forgive as God would have us do. It is not right that we should hold a grudge in our hearts. The doer of this act is going to find it very difficult indeed to live with himself. His only peace of mind will be when he goes to God for forgiveness. Let us not stand in the way, but instead give prayers that he may find his peace." The car was parked on a promontory where Perry and Dick had stopped to picnic. It was noon. Dick scanned the view through a pair of binoculars. Mountains. Hawks wheeling in a white sky. A dusty road winding into and out of a white and dusty village. Today was his second day in Mexico, and so far he liked it fine. Even the food. At this very moment he was eating a cold, oily tortilla. They had crossed the border at Laredo, Texas, the morning of November 23rd, and spent the first night in a San Luis Potosí brothel. They were now 200 miles north of their next destination, Mexico City. "Know what I think?" said Perry. "I think there must be something wrong with us. To do what we did."
"Did what?"
"Out there." Dick dropped the binoculars into a leather case, a luxurious receptacle initialed HWC. He was annoyed. Annoyed as hell. Why the hell couldn't Perry shut up? Christ Jesus, what damn good did it do, always dragging the goddamn thing up? It really was annoying. Especially since they'd agreed, sort of, not to talk about the goddamn thing. Just forget it. "There's got to be something wrong with somebody who'd do a thing like that," Perry said. "Deal me out, baby," Dick said. "I'm a normal." And Dick meant what he said. He thought himself as balanced, as sane as anyone. Maybe a bit smarter than the average fellow, that's all. But Perry. There was, in Dick's opinion, something wrong with little Perry. To say the least. Last spring, when they had celled together at Kansas State Penitentiary, he'd learned most of Perry's lesser peculiarities. Perry could be such a kid, always wetting his bed and crying in his sleep. "Dad, I've been looking everywhere. Where you been, Dad?" And often Dick had seen him sit for hours just sucking his thumb and poring over them phony damn treasure guides. Which was one side. There were others. In some ways, old Perry was spooky as hell. Take, for instance, that temper of his. He could slide into a fury quicker than 10 drunk Indians. And yet, you wouldn't know it. He might be ready to kill you, but you'd never know it, Not to look at or listen to, Dick once said. For however extreme the inward rage, outwardly Perry remained a cool young tough, with eyes serene and slightly sleepy. The time had been when Dick had thought he could control, could regulate the temperature of these sudden cold fevers that burned and chilled his friend. He had been mistaken, and in the aftermath of that discovery had grown very unsure of Perry, not at all certain what to think, except that he felt he ought to be afraid of him, and wondered really why he wasn't. Deep down, Perry continued, way, way rock bottom. I never thought I could do it. A thing like that. How about the nigger? Dick said. Silence. Dick realized that Perry was staring at him. A week ago, in Kansas City, Perry had bought a pair of dark glasses. Fancy ones with silver lacquered rims and mirrored lenses. Dick disliked them. He'd told Perry he was ashamed to be seen with anyone who'd wear that kind of flit stuff. Actually, what irked him was the mirrored lenses. It was unpleasant having Perry's eyes hidden behind the privacy of those tinted reflecting surfaces. But a nigger, said Perry. That's different. The comment, the reluctance with which it was pronounced, made Dick ask, or did you? Kill him like you said. It was a significant question, for his original interest in Perry, his assessment of Perry's character and potentialities, was founded on the story Perry had once told him of how he had beaten a colored man to death. Sure I did. Only a nigger. It's not the same. Then Perry said, know what it is that really bugs me? About the other thing? It's just that I don't believe it. That anyone can get away with a thing like that. Because I don't see how it's possible to do what we did and just 100% get away with it. I mean, that's what bugs me. I can't get it out of my head that something's got to happen. Though as a child he had attended church, Dick had never come near a belief in God, nor was he troubled by superstitions. Unlike Perry, he was not convinced that a broken mirror meant 7 years' misfortune, or that a young moon, if glimpsed through glass, portended evil. But Perry, with his sharp and scratchy intuitions, had hit upon Dick's one abiding doubt. Dick, too, suffered moments when that question circled inside his head. Was it possible? Were the two of them, honest to God, going to get away with doing a thing like that? Suddenly, he said to Perry, now just shut up. Then he gunned the motor and backed the car off the promontory. Ahead of him, on the dusty road, he saw a dog trotting along in the warm sunshine. Mountains. Hawks wheeling in a white sky. When Perry asked Dick, know what I think? He knew he was beginning a conversation that would displease Dick. And one that, for that matter, he himself would just as soon avoid. He agreed with Dick. Why go on talking about it? But he could not always stop himself. Spells of helplessness occurred, moments when he remembered things. Blue light exploding in a black room, the glass eyes of a big toy bear, and when voices, a particular few words, started nagging his mind. Oh, no. Oh, please. No, 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 don't. Oh, please don't, please. And certain sounds returned. A silver dollar rolling across a floor, boot steps on hardwood stairs, and the sounds of breathing, the gasps, the hysterical inhalations of a man with a severed windpipe. When Perry said, I think there must be something wrong with us, he was making an admission he hated to make. After all, it was painful to imagine that one might be not just right, particularly if whatever was wrong was not your own fault, but maybe a thing you were born with. Look at his family. Look at what had happened there. His mother, an alcoholic, had strangled to death on her own vomit. Of her children, 2 sons and 2 daughters, only the younger girl, Barbara, had entered ordinary life. Married.